Morning, Graham. Can you hear me? Hey, so how was your week?
I haven't thought about that.
There's something about this particular summer, I think, that seems to be going ever more quickly, certainly for those of us of senior years, and the political weather is certainly part of that. I wonder what you make of events across the pond. Biden stepping down, the manner in which he did it, some would say rather belatedly and reluctantly. Perhaps peevishly off camera, and the ascendance and rapid turnaround, at least financially, of Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I think that's determined my week. A huge sense of relief that Biden has stepped down, and there's Kamala mania on the rampage.
You don't think she's speaking too soon?
I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, she's stepping up to the occasion, I think, because and it's getting the response because everyone's sending their money. And the idea that Trump is now up against a prosecutor must be his worst nightmare.
There is a delicious irony about that, isn't there, I guess? Mark, good morning. Welcome back. How are you?
Hi.
Did you do your
Yeah,
morning
fine, thank
swimming?
you. Yes, yeah, struggling on.
Excellent.
Can you hear me?
Well, you're in fine fettle, sir. We started talking about the Biden-Harris handover, and Graham's impressed so far. What say you?
Well, it certainly changed the nature of the race in a most radical way. It was hardly unexpected. I think the pressure on Biden had been growing to deafening proportions for some time. We'll have to see. I mean, now there is a real contrast in personality and style, which I mean there was in a sense with the others, but for two very old men, not I should say there's nothing wrong with that as such. Being very close to that category myself, but
Talk
the at least yeah, she's more. I mean, I think the Democrats have very significant problems. I think there are some areas in which they're alienating potentially their own base. For example, their stance on trans issues. I think he's alienating quite a lot of their female base. Kamala is also, you know, Harris is. I think she's questionable on some of the anti-Semitic issues, although I hope she can deal with that. But I think, frankly, Trump would have walked it had Biden stayed the candidate. It's now very, very difficult to call again, which is a good thing for democracy.
Yes, indeed. So, no sooner does she take up the mantle that Netanyahu arrives and addresses Congress, which in and of itself ruffle a few feathers. So she steps up to the dais and has a position prepared, also it would seem, that seems to take account of both sides and the two-state solution. So straight away, she's I suppose, perhaps to her benefit optically, if she calls it right. She's thrust into what would otherwise be a post-election a decisional framework.
Well, yes, I mean it's the big foreign policy issue of the day, obviously, even more so than Ukraine. And the big, I think, the big question for all of us outside the US is going to be how the new president, whoever it should be, will approach the international role of the US. Trump has always been rather isolationist. Now, one aspect of that was he was the first American president in living memory not to start a foreign war, which generally speaking, I suspect one would regard as being a good thing. But whether that means when
Very
it
good
comes
position.
to standing up to Putin or to others, then I think there are questions about how good Trump would be for the rest of the world, and particularly I think for Europe. We don't really know enough of Kamala Harris as yet. I mean, vice president is pretty much in an invisible role, really, despite what Trump is claiming for her. And so we don't really know all that much about her substance. We know a bit about her style. But it's going to be the shortest presidential campaign in history. She didn't challenged Biden for the nomination earlier. So the rate at which she's raising money is impressive, and we'll see how it turns out.
Mm. Meanwhile, over here, in a slightly different part of the forest, the Tory leadership campaign is beginning to gather momentum. Tom Tugendhat, with the unfortunate moniker, I think, in his campaign strategy, a bit scatological. Kimmy Badenoch is in the frame, isn't she? One or two others. I suppose this has also come up in a fairly peremptory fashion. But what do you think the prospects are for a Tory conference that will be an exercise in restructuring?
Well, I just like in 1997, I couldn't really see why William Hague wanted to be Conservative leader at that stage. There's an element of that. I mean, having said that, although this is an enormous majority in terms of votes, it's very, very shallow for Labour. There are vast numbers of very, very marginal constituencies. And in fact, you know, they barely picked up a third of the votes that were cast. So in other words, roughly speaking, one in five adults or one in five people who were capable, who were eligible to vote, voted Labour in the election that's just been. So although it is a massive majority, and it looks a massive majority, and the opposition is split, unlike the huge majority, say, of the Thatcher years or the Blair years, opposition was focused in the main opposition party. Clearly, in terms of seats, that's not the case now. But it's a majority that could be overturned on a remarkably small swing, given the size of the majority. So from that point of view, I think the Tories, it's more understandable why someone might want to lead the Tories now than I thought it was directly after the first Blair landslide in 1997. That being said, you know, the Tories now need a period of going back and thinking about it. As I think I may have mentioned before, my sort of take on this is when the party does lose after a while in office, it tends to retreat to its own ideological comfort zone. So we saw this with Michael Foote after Thatcher won in 1979, and Neil Kinnock to begin with, who was quite left-wing. Then we saw it with William Hague and Ian Duncan Smith when the Tories lost in 97. And then we saw it with Miliband and Corbyn when Labour lost in 2010. And then someone comes along. It was actually Neil Kinnock who came to his senses, I think, with Labour and decided it'd be nice if Labour got back into power. It was Michael Howard with the Tories, and now Keir Starmer with Labour, came back along thinking we ought to really be a bit more sensible and make ourselves electable again. The Tories will probably have to go through the batten down the hatches phase, and it tends to last between 5 and 10 years, actually, before someone comes along who's sensible to leave. But Tugendhat, I do find quite an attractive candidate, so maybe the Tories will come to their senses more rapidly.
Mm. Graham, there's been talk this week from Chris Philp. He would say that, wouldn't he, about the Labour levels on the two-child restriction benefit cap and the suspension of these seven Labour MPs. And the suggestion being that the numerically fragile majority that Starmer has could also be subject to serial and growing rebellion. The aforementioned Mr. Corbyn on the sidelines suggesting there might be an alliance of these rebels. But with that in mind, but also with regard to the continuity of democracy and, I suppose, a set of values that are, some would say, are sort of germane to British tradition, should we be concerned about where the Tory party goes next? Or should we simply leave them to their own devices and in their comfort zone, as Mal calls it?
Well, it's very interesting listening to Malcolm's analysis as how politicians think. I would have thought that it doesn't really matter what kind of, it's just the number of seats. It's all that matters, because it's going to take individual elections to get rid of any of them. That's the majority he's got is whatever, 410 seats.
Some people might say it's the ease with which the red stroke blue wall split, for example, in recent years, and how sort of centrist and almost center right Starmer's had to appear to be to sort of be within the Overton window, notwithstanding all that's gone on economically.
Yeah, but it's a very complex calculation as to how to bring them to election. I mean, I think the rebels have learned a trick from the Conservatives about using their rebellion, you know, to affect the majority of the leader. I mean, can Labour also send in letters? I don't think they work that way, do they?
I don't think they do. Mal, could you advise us? There's the equivalent of something like the 1922 committee.
Well, no, because you recall when they tried to unseat Corbyn, the way that could be done. Well, there didn't seem to be a formal mechanism to do it. So 2/3, was it, of the parliamentary party, or perhaps more, put a vote of no confidence in Corbyn. He kept with it. So I presume there must be a way, probably through the National Executive Committee, which is the governing body of Labour, that a leader could be overturned. But I'm not aware of it ever happening in that sense with the Labour Party, of a leader actually being sacked, certainly not in my living memory.
Yeah, it's quite a prospect, isn't it? Because the stakes were so high, and the majority is, as you say, numerically fairly slim. What do you make of this rebellion and the... So is the two-child restriction in the road in terms of the fact that, for example, Rachel Reeves is reporting, what is it now, £25 billion deficit in terms of what possibly expect to be able to have leverage over in terms of the necessary spend?
Well, that's the... setting out their strategy that it's an economic question, not a social question, and that the Labour Party is saying they simply can't afford it, the country can't afford it, therefore they're not going to do it under a justice label. So, I mean, I think again, that will be accepted by a lot of people as an anti-Tory policy.
So you mean in the sense that there is an economic prudence there, but also an acknowledgement that it's an important issue?
Yes, that is, you have to accept the consequences of overspending, as you can't afford to do other things. This happens to be the first one that's come up. So it's the one to set the principle on that you can only pay for what you can afford.
Yeah.
And you can't overspend. And it's a Tory weakness to have overspent and damaged the economy with Brexit.
That said, I think last week Reeves was referring, or at least hinting, that public sector pay rises could be inflation at that, and in the wake of a teacher strike that happened just a couple of days after the election result, if I remember rightly, I guess pre-scheduled, it would have happened whichever government had been, or type of government had been formed. But at the same time, these grievances are apparent, irrespective of the political cycle, aren't they? Is the trouble brewing here?
Well, that's another confirmation of that. That's the policy. You say how much the Tories have overspent, and therefore that justifies all your subsequent policies, that you can't afford it. Mm. I think that's the sort of general pattern. Conservatives were blaming Labour for Corbyn and for all his policies.
Yeah, there's some default largesse, as it were, that didn't seem to take any account of economic reality in their view. Now, I wonder if we could look at this from a local perspective. I mean, food bank use, I think, regionally has been up quite significantly. Do you think that child poverty is an issue that is resonating locally? There was a council meeting on Wednesday night, for example, wasn't there? Ian Tatham recently co-chaired a food poverty commission in Wandsworth, which reported a few months ago. He came on and talked about it. Do you feel that this is an issue as prominent regionally as it could be nationally?
Well, yes. I mean, there are, you know, Londoners has a London as a whole has a particular issue with child poverty, and that affects Wandsworth. I wouldn't say perhaps as much as some of the poorer boroughs, but it certainly does affect Wandsworth. Didn't really come up in the council meeting on Wednesday, which was a very bad-tempered affair, always.
That's a shame, on a hot night.
Yeah, I mean, I'd hope by now that 2 years in that things would be settling down a bit, but the Labour group is forcing through some changes to the constitution of the council, which makes it more difficult to oppose. And I think that's a big mistake, because I think we've seen a number of occasions in the last few weeks where the council has really been, I think, badly let down, or the governance, the leading group in the council, the administration, has been really badly let down over issues where things could have been dealt with far simpler. I mean, perhaps the most prevalent one at the moment is the food waste and the recycling, which is going very badly in some areas and which the council didn't seem to be ready for. We also had the issue of the election count in Putney, where 6,000 votes were left off the final voting tallies, and that only came to light a week or so later. And at the council meeting on Wednesday, it was a minor thing, but the leader in the question referred to food waste, which has prevented material going to landfill, when Wandsworth hasn't used landfill for many years. And it's a string of things where I think I think it would be in the best interest, my view, of the administration, if they actually gave more space to the opposition to stop them making these sorts of mistakes, because they're not reflecting well on the current administration. The issue of child poverty is a difficult one. If you raise the cap on two children, you're in effect saying to society, if you're on benefits, you can have as many children as you like, and we'll take money away from taxpayers to support them. If you aren't rich enough to pay, if you are earning enough not to be on benefits, then you won't get any support of that nature, and indeed we'll be taking money away from you. So you're going to have to limit the number of children you have. And I think that's a very dangerous signal to send to society on the one hand. On the other hand, we obviously don't want to see children living in poverty whose parents, for whatever reason, have had a very large family that they're not financially able to support. Because it's not the children's fault, whatever decisions we might be looking at on the part of the parents. So it's a very, very difficult issue to get right. It's striking that within a couple of weeks of being elected, there's a group of left-wing MPs who decided that they didn't see any reason why they should be bound by the manifesto they'd just been elected on. And I think I was slightly surprised at the rapidity and extent of the action that the Prime Minister took over that. May well be, though, that it shows something for the future as to how he's going to govern, and perhaps he's not going to accept the relatively small left-wing clique of the Labour Party who might want to destabilise his government. So it looks like he's going to be quite tough on them.
Yes, do you think it will remain relatively small rather than a sort of rump of independent Labour who may have lingering resentments from the Starmer purges prior to the election?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. And definitions of left and right are movable feasts. Before the election, we had the Tories claiming that Rishi Sunak was a socialist and left wing. And we had Labour claiming that Keir Starmer was a right-wing bordering on fascist. These words can be used interchangeably and in very, very loose definitions, depending on where you stand yourself politically. But as it stands at the moment, it's interesting that there were only seven rebellion people. So, for example, Diane Abbott, who you kind of put on your bingo card for a rebellion and sort of walk on, did not rebel against the government. Many of the others who might have been sort of poster children for the left stayed in line. So I don't know. I mean, one of the classic problems of massive majorities is that since the formal opposition is so weak and lacking in credibility, which the Tories will be for at least a time now, then you can end up with the opposition emerging from the government benches or the administration benches. And that can then, who knows where it goes in that sort of area. You know where you are with a formal opposition. You don't really know where you are if it's your own side that's doing the opposing.
Yeah, shades of two Brutus and all that. I was watching Bernie Sanders on YouTube last night talking about Harris and obviously for the convention before formalising an endorsement. But he was talking about the fact that the Democrats appear to have left the middle classes hanging somewhat and being somewhat politically homeless. And I'm wondering if that, in terms, for example, of the cost of living crisis and the way it squeezes the middle in this country culturally, whether this isn't something that the Labour Party should be more aware of, the fact that there are people who hitherto, when they initially decided to have a largish family, found that economically viable, would have run into difficulties. Graham, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, but it sounds as if it's much more an internal disciplinary driven action. He's just asserting what Malcolm has said, that they're not following the manifesto, and therefore it doesn't matter what it is, what the issue is.
The King's Speech, which is, I suppose, could be treasonable, couldn't it, in previous incarnations?
Well, that's the consensus of what it means. So I don't think he's not setting out exactly what his opinion or policy is on the two child issue.
In the context of this £25 billion deficit, I mean, it's a sticky wicket, if ever there was one. But what about the middle classes in this country and across the pond? Are they still politically homeless to some extent, but tick the box for Labour in hope, and then, as it were, the kind of the dawn, the bills falling on the mat and so forth, doubts could occur?
I just think the sort of nationalisation of the coastline for wind power is quite popular with both sides, the Crown as well.
Indeed. Well, if you need to nip up to Liverpool or lead down to London, I think there is a fairly consistent level of traffic there, as there has been since the 60s. Getting stuck at Crewe almost created a sort of tented community, didn't it, for quite some time? Those outliers down in Chris Groening territory who were still raging at the signal box at Seven Oaks. This is, as you say, no small beer. It's the ability of people to be economically active depends on their ability to travel, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think it's the launch of the GB Energy, isn't it? I mean, it's that's definitely a middle class concern, an interest to get involved in the commercial operation of the country.
I think you make a very pertinent point there. Mal, broadly speaking, I know you've always had doubts about nationalisation. Do you think it's the right call in the current economic circumstances to do, I guess, particularly in terms of your professional area of interest, GB Energy, but also the nationalisation of the railways. Were you impressed by that? Are you impressed by the potential rollout?
Well, it's very interesting that in all of the literature leading up to the election, the Labour Party was saying that they'd save £300 a year on power bills or energy bills by establishing GB Energy. Within the last week, that's been entirely abandoned. It became up to £300 for a little while. Now they're saying there won't be any savings at all in the course of the next Parliament. Mm. I've always felt electricity is a special case because you can't store it in reasonable quantities. And storage is essential to the workings of a market. If you say, a shoe manufacturer, then you can manufacture your shoes at any time of day or night if you like. You put them in storage at a relatively modest cost. It's not zero cost, but you can store shoes in warehouses fairly cheaply and then release them to the market at the point when the people actually want to buy the shoes. With electricity, the equivalent would be that every time someone came into a shop saying they wanted a shoe, you would have to manufacture the shoe there and then. Because we can't store meaningful amounts of electricity. There are small amounts through pumped storage and maybe eventually through batteries. But on grid scales, there's no real prospect that I can see that we're going to be able to store more than a few seconds or maybe a few minutes of electricity across the economy as a whole. That really means that for the vast bulk of our electricity, we've got to make it as it is needed. Now, the demand for electricity varies by about a factor of three from a cold winter's night across to 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning in late July, early August. And so to keep electricity secure, you both need enough power stations to fulfill that peak demand on the cold winter's night, which is, in the terms of the day, something of the order of 70,000 megawatts or 70 gigawatts. Capacity, but recognise that quite a lot of that capacity won't have a market throughout the rest of the year, and indeed some of it may only be operating for a few hours a year. So you've got to have a price structure that rewards the companies for keeping this generating capacity available for the times that it is absolutely needed, but is sitting around being maintained, having staffing implications, having fuel available, without a market for, you know, perhaps 99% of the year in some cases. That's not easy to do. And what a market tends to do is to limit the amount of capacity there, cherry pick there, and at the time when demand is at the highest, either charge eye-watering amounts for the electricity or allow power cuts eventually. And it's not particularly in the bad interests of the generators to allow power cuts from now on. Then it pushes prices up generally, puts everybody in a panic, and the only prices for a short period of year, they're not exploiting the market. So you need a massive amount of central guidance to create a system. You've got to start with what they call capacity payments. You've got to pay generators to keep capacity available, even if it's never needed in the year because it happens to be a particularly mild winter or whatever it is. That needs massive intervention from the regulator and from the market operator. And there comes a point where you say, is the amount of intervention that's needed such a level that you haven't got a market at all? You've got a directed thing, in which case you might as well do it at state rates of return and lower rates of interest and save money that way. So I think there's a very respectable argument about electricity, less so about gas, which you can store. But around electricity, there is quite a respectable argument around, in effect, nationalising it, because government can borrow far more cheaply than anyone else. And then government takes responsibility for the electricity mix. One way of doing it is government pays for the capacity, but then it allows a market to actually operate it efficiently. So there are hybrid models. But these are long-term investments. You know, renewables, if you simply look at the cost of producing the unit of electricity, then renewables are quite attractive now. But a lot of those units are not coming at the right time. You know, on a cold, still winter's night, you obviously got no sun. You've got very little wind. That's the reason why it's so cold, is that there isn't wind blowing warmer air around. In those circumstances, then you have to have a huge backup capacity that has to be paid for, probably natural gas, as we are building more nuclear at last, but it will only replace the nuclear coming offline over the next few years. In those circumstances, it was never realistic to imagine that a company which was going to develop renewables was going to bring prices down, at least in the short to medium term, probably never. And I think the government's been caught out by that.
So, well, in terms of it being such a big sale, Graham, that seems to, as it were, chip away a little bit at the credibility of GB Energy. Would you agree with Malcolm's analysis?
Well, yeah, and it's another argument for hydrogen or tidal in the long term.
About which they've been making some noise this past week or two, I think, haven't they? Yes. Yeah.
But it's also, if we revert to the previous issue, it's going to be responded to by saying, well, you've had 14 years to design the system and you've done nothing. So I think that's more likely to be something that the public would understand, which is, after all, is what the politicians are trying to communicate, isn't it? It's how bad the other side are and how they're going to solve the problems.
So remedial work, even if the bills don't appreciably go down in the foreseeable future.
Yeah. To be fair to the outgoing government, and including the coalition, the percentage of electricity generated by non-carbon sources has increased very significantly over the last 15 years in the UK. Nuclear has slipped back a bit with the closure of the first AGRs. But we have seen a very significant expansion in wind and solar in the UK. And so it's unfair to claim that the outgoing government didn't have a number of successes in that field. I think it did, probably as much as any other country in Europe. The problem is that you can integrate renewables into the system quite easily up to a certain level. But after that, because they're not generating when you want them to, and so managing grid stability when you have a growing proportion of unreliable input to it, it just becomes a lot more difficult at a certain point. And you're getting up to 20, probably 30% wind is relatively straightforward, and several countries have done it. When you're moving towards 40 or 50% or even higher, then it suddenly starts to get a lot more difficult. And the other point is also, you need to build massive new wire networks, for example, to carry wind from the offshore farms, which are by definition off the coast, into the heartlands of where power is used, which is the industrial areas of the country in the Midlands and, of course, the southeast. So a wind farm in the Irish Sea, you need a lot of wires to bring the wind onshore, which is expensive, but you then need a lot of wires to carry it into the grid, and then you get the environmental objections about the effect of generating towers, or transmission towers, which, you know, traditionally have been a real focus for civil unrest. Germany didn't install or didn't wire up a single offshore wind generator in 2021. And that was simply because of the environmentalist protests against the new transmission lines to take the electricity from the off the coast of Germany, northern coast of Germany, into the industrial heartlands.
Isn't it? Given the fact that pre-planning and the long-range strategy appears to have been absent with regard to energy policy, I wonder if there's a comparison to be drawn with Baroness Hallett doing the initial tranche of the COVID inquiry, the initial report, which points to the fact that, as amongst others, Osborne pointed out, not a lot was happening, not a lot of money was accorded the potential for an epidemic to occur. In the years around 2005 to 2011, the idea was that there might potentially be some major outbreak of influenza, but that the SARS epidemic in the early noughties wasn't really reviewed as a phenomenon. And infrastructure appears to have been rather downplayed in terms of potential impact. I'm wondering how you feel about that as a revelation, and whether eventually we think heads are going to start slowly rolling.
Well, I think that was always the criticism during the pandemic, was that they hadn't prepared, and they should have prepared, and they were well. I don't think it's going to have much of an impact. I think that people are much more waiting for the later reports on the profiteering that occurred during the pandemic.
It's going to be Starmer is establishing a commission to attempt to recoup those funds, or at least trace where they went to. So you're thinking this will be more a case of lessons learned and wringing of hands rather than accountability?
Well, I think it's more Starmer establishing his modus operandi, you know, that people are going to have to follow the leader, and it's internal discipline of the party that's important to establish at the moment.
In contrast to the laissez-faire, I suppose you could say, that was optically symbolised by Partygate and so forth.
Well, it's just the chaos, the previous chaos.
Yeah.
I agree with Malcolm that transition, UK is leading the way in most areas, except the grid. The grid is the blockage in the transition. And that's at the heart of infrastructure planning, of course.
So there is then a link, according to what you're saying there. Mal, would you concur with that? And indeed, should there be, in the midst of the current economic crisis, also a thinking forward to whatever else may be coming down the pike? I mean, there are isolated cases of COVID in the country now. As someone said to me the other day in the day job, not considered particularly sexy, but nonetheless there, so that we're not entirely out of the woods yet.
No, the nature of modern life, the amount of international commerce in the widest sense, including human interactions, has always made it easier for epidemics to occur. I mean, the last great one, the Spanish flu of 1918 developed largely because, or one of the ways it was transmitted, was troops who had been living in very concentrated conditions during the
Third World War. And transported in very very cramped conditions. Yeah. Hmm.
And indeed, yes, and then being dispersed back into their home communities across the world. And so the flu bug had a ready-made transport system to carry it far and wide, and we ended up with the many millions of deaths that we know about. These days, you don't need a special event of that nature. It's normal life that it can be happening. Now, in a sense, we were lucky with COVID because it had a very low mortality rate. I mean, that's absolutely no comfort to the many people who did lose loved ones to it. But in terms, say, of the earlier SARS viruses, SARS family viruses, where some of them were very, very difficult to catch, but had 20, 30, 40, even higher percentage mortality rates. You know, COVID had most of us who got COVID came through it. There are big questions over the long-term effects of long COVID. But in terms of the actual survival rates through the epidemic itself, it was very good. It was comparable. Yes, indeed. I mean, of course, I'm in no way being insensitive to those who were affected, and the issue with that it's obviously its age profile was unusual in that, unlike most diseases, it hardly touched children. Now, most diseases, of course, are most lethal for the very young and the very old. That wasn't the case with COVID, elderly people who usually, you know, the vast majority were people who had other medical conditions at the same time.
Yes.
It was, yeah, just point I'm making is we kind of dodged a bullet to an extent with COVID. It could have been an awful lot worse. And the next epidemic could be an awful lot worse. And the report that's come out this week shows just how woeful we were. We, you know, the previous government had closed down a lot of the research into it, and they focused on a flu-type epidemic with very different characteristics from the COVID one that we saw, where, for example, there was seemed to be quite a long period between you catching the virus and becoming infectious and the first appearance of the symptoms. Now, that's not usually the case with flu, where you get ill very quickly with it. So, yeah, a variety of reasons. Now, you can't, yeah, it's very difficult to imagine you could foresee all possible epidemics of this sort and prepare for all of them. But it's not very sexy. You know, when you are, have an economy where the direct needs of the health service and the education service and the need for public sector pay to go up and so on are pressing events that can cause government problems tomorrow, then putting money into something where, if it is successful, it'll hardly be noticed because it will have been successful and people won't notice the epidemic, is, I can understand why that's politically difficult and how you balance the amount of money you put into something that may never happen. There were a lot of scares about epidemics that didn't, that then didn't happen before COVID did. I can understand that it's politically difficult for government.
Leonie, good morning. Welcome. How are you?
Hi, how are you? Technical issues, sorry.
Oh, thank you for your persistence. If there's anything we can do at our end, consider it done. We've covered a fair bit of ground. We'd started talking about GB Energy, apparently not saving a lot of people a great deal of money in the short term, but nonetheless laying the ground for infrastructure. And then we moved on there to forward planning and the review of the sheer lack of it that Baroness Hallett's report is revealed this week with regard to Covidiana.
I mean, both of those big topics, I can imagine that you've had a lot to say.
Well, we were anxiously awaiting your input here, but are you impressed by Hallett's scholarship here, and what's your reaction to the fact that things were as they were during, for example, the Condem years, and there's Osborne rocking up and saying, in view of repairing those while the sun was shining, that didn't seem to be happening very much.
Well, I think Malcolm's hit the nail on the head, though, that trying to shift everyone's attention onto preventative, whether it's preventative in terms of a big pandemic or preventative measures that stop the demands on the health service, which more widely, which is clearly what really needs to happen. And I have heard the new Secretary of State talking about that. But it is something that this government would be more likely to tackle than the previous government, which had a strong belief around, well, people should make their own decisions. But of course, allowing lots of people to make their own decisions about very, you know, then make very poor choices, we then end up in a situation where, well, a lot of those people, of course, who've made very poor choices around you know, lack of exercise and gross obesity. And, you know, some of it, of course, is very difficult to just say their choices because it is the environment, the food environment that we live in. Of course, we're particularly vulnerable to COVID as well. So I think, you know, trying to persuade people is one thing, but actually creating a different environment to make the choice is easier for people, I think, is part of an overall preventative strategy. And I do think we need to be moving towards that. And we do need to be looking at the way that big companies have, you know, now started creating all these products that are just completely unhealthy for us. So I think there is a need to change our approach to how we treat health. Because otherwise you'll just never get this preventative approach into the way that we operate.
I wonder if we could link that somewhat tendentiously perhaps to what we were saying earlier on about the Labour rebellions over the two-child benefit cap and whether that's a bit of a smoking gun and whether this, you know, perhaps necessary now, given the £25 billion deficit that Reeves appears to be squaring up to, it reflects the fact that in potentially here and across the pond, as Sardis was saying the other night, I think the middle classes could potentially be left behind a bit economically, as indeed arguably they were in the Tory years.
I think things are going to continue to be difficult. There's no doubt about that. And I think that's going to continue to impact on, you know, a wider cohort, which it clearly is now, because of the way in which the tax bans and where they kick in, they've been frozen. And the current government never said it was going to move them any more than the previous government did, apart from for pensioners, where it said it would move them. You know, I think we're, and I don't think anyone should be surprised by what happened over the two-child benefit cap, voting against the first King's speech by this flavour of government for 14 years. And it was made pretty obvious that you know, people would be expected to support it. Lots of people who would like the two-child benefit cap to be altered either voted with the government or, in some cases, there were some abstentions. And then just seven people decided to do what they did. And, you know, whether you agree with the consequence that was meted out to them, that was quite strong, shall we say.
Six-month
suspension is quite a strong. It's a pretty clear message to a very large parliamentary Labour Party that, you know, we expect you to vote with the government. And given the vast number of new MPs who are in there, I can also see why they did it. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with it, but I can. And they must have been told in advance, because so many other people, including a woman who herself was talking about putting down her own amendment, she voted with the government in the end. I mean, it's always pretty frowned upon to vote with opposition amendments on motions that have been put down by your own side. And if it's an opposition an amendment to a King's speech, very strongly frowned upon. So I can see why it happened. I think they have now probably made themselves irrelevant, which is very, you know, which is sad.
And these are some big beasts from yesterday, the McDonald's, the Birkins and so forth, and their particular sort of fiefdoms, as it were. So you don't foresee an independent Labour tranche within Parliament being a significant force?
I don't see how there could ever be enough of them. I mean, there's Jeremy, who entered as an independent, and a couple of other people who came in as independents who defeated Labour people, and these seven. I mean, seven plus maybe five, plus four Greens, and they're never going to vote with Reform because they'll go off in a different direction. I mean, even if there were 10 of them, and there aren't, I mean, that still leaves 400 Labour MPs. So that's no influence at all. They can't defeat the government. I heard Jonathan Ashworth, who was one of the MPs who lost his seat to an independent...
Yeah,
he's now running Labour Together, I think it is. And he was saying, I don't know what they were thinking of voting. He was being very rude. He said a ragtag and bobtail of, you know, and was then very rude about all the other people together. And the majority was enormous. So, but I mean, you know, the parliamentary arithmetic speaks. They have the vast numbers and they will have the vast numbers for 5 years. It would take massive rebellions to... I mean, it would take, you know, over 200 of Labour MPs rebelling against the government practically to make a difference. It's not going to happen.
So but it's perhaps a little bit sort of polyhour for Chris Phillips to suggest that it could all be over by Easter if the scale of rebellion exponentially continues. Gentlemen, how do you feel about what Leon is saying about the ground we covered.
There is a problem with huge majorities around the patronage, that if you have a relatively small majority, then the proportion of governmental posts to the total number of your MPs is obviously considerably higher than if you have a massive majority. You've still only got around 100 odd governmental posts to give out. Now, when people, and the new, I don't know what the number is of new Labour MPs among the intake, it must be in the several hundreds. Now, to begin with, it's all very exciting and you're learning the ropes. Perhaps you don't want to ruffle feathers too much to begin with. But there comes a point where people who think they're up to being ministers, and some of them will be right, they are up to being ministers, but there aren't enough ministerial posts to go around. And at that point, you can begin to get the startings of rumblings against the leader. And by the time you've been leader for 10 years, so towards the end of the Thatcher or the Blair prime ministerships, a very significant proportion of your parliamentary party is either people who were in ministerial positions and you've sacked, or people who thought they should be in ministerial positions who have never been promoted. And growth of dissatisfaction is noticeable as as administrations or as premierships move on in time. And it was noticeable how Blair and Thatcher both lasted around the 10-year mark, slightly longer in Thatcher's case. I don't think either of them felt that they'd run out of ideas and didn't want to continue doing the job. I think it was just that they recognised that too many of their colleagues were fed up from a personal career point of view. So now it'll be a while before that becomes an issue for Keir Starmer, but it will become an issue at some point. And how he manages the party. I remember Simon Milton, the inspirational leader of Westminster Council some years ago, saying that 40% of his time as leader of Westminster City, one of the biggest, most important local authorities in the country, this was before the days of the Great London Assembly and the Mayor for London, but saying that 40% of his time was just spent managing his political group. It's a big, big issue, and the bigger that group is, Westminster, the Conservative group in Westminster was around 50 at that time. Keir Starmer's got not far short of 10 times that number of people to manage. And how he manages the party, I think, is going to be not so much an issue now, but will become a really big issue in the later years of this parliament.
So the Simon Milton argument, Graham, that Mal's citing, suggests that it's not a bad idea to at least talk to the people who might be seeking to rebel against you to see if there's a middle path.
Yeah, that's why they often talk about the Prime Minister isn't spending enough time in the tea rooms, which is code for not being anywhere near the 40% that Malcolm just mentioned. I would agree with all of that. I think the only thing that keeps the numbers more on side is there's about 100 ministerial posts of various different levels, cabinet downwards. There's also the unpaid posts of being somebody's PPS, a parliamentary private secretary. So they are all kind of on the, on the...
That's your first rung of the ladder very often, isn't it? I think.
You can't keep a PPS if you don't vote with the government. So that takes it up to 200 because you can be a PPS to every single minister. And then finally, if you want to be the chair of a select committee or something like that, you normally need the support of your own colleagues as well as other MPs across the House as well. So that can also bring people into line, although it's important once they're elected to those positions that they then have some independence of thought and can hold. But that does keep people very busy. I mean, chairing the Public Accounts Committee, which Meg Hillier has been doing for the last few years and before her Margaret Hodge, it is a really big job, and chairing some of the other select committees where they drag people in front of them who've done good things.
Sometimes, yes.
Certainly in the case of Boris Johnson, who behaved abominably, it wouldn't go to them. I think those can be quite absorbing. And of course, MPs, some MPs just decide that you know, being a minister isn't really for them, and plough their own furrow and get very involved in, you know, other aspects of being an MP, because you can, you know, you can use it as a platform for all sorts of other things. So I think it's possibly not as dire as Malcolm says in terms of the numbers, but yes, no, it is true that rounding up cats and herding them is rather similar to rounding up groups of politicians and trying to keep them on side for lengthy periods of time.
It's the heady optics there. We started with Graham and the sudden rise of Kamala Harris with record numbers of donations coming in, and the somewhat reluctant stepping down of Biden. And I think just last night or yesterday, Trump withdrawing from a debate and being a bit ruffled. J.D. Vance, of course, calling about childish cat ladies. With this interesting and sort of discreetly implied misogyny there, or maybe not so discreetly.
Discreet? No, I don't think you could say that Vance or Trump are discreet. I don't. You can call them many words. Discreet is not one of the
words.
They're
not known for it, are they? Whether they
no, yeah. No. Subtle. Subtle is another word that could never be applied to. Never knowingly subtle, I think you could say about both of them, actually. I mean, it's going to be a full frontal, you know, attack on Kamala Harris about the fact that she keeps cats or doesn't have children or any other matter that they choose to go for. And
it's ad hominem, isn't it? It's not really about the policies.
It's always ad hominem with Trump. He is just one of those people. If you expect him to raise his game and to actually, you know, not do personal attacks, I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed right up until November the whatever the date is. November the 5th, I think.
105 days and counting, I think. Yes.
Yeah, you've got 105 days. I feel sorry for Biden. You know, if he's, you know, got these mental problems that sort of kick in, but not all the time. He's always been a scrapper and a fighter. He's had to really push through so many difficulties in his life, and always before he's been able to sort of, you know, say, no, I'm going to do it, and by sheer force of will, you know, get rid of his stutter, overcome so many difficulties, and then, you know, push through. But this one is one that, you know, he just can't possibly push through and carry on with. I mean, the debate with Trump was just, I mean, it was awful. But I felt sorry for him. And of course, when he's in that state, he probably doesn't have self-awareness because he's, you know, because he's suffering from cognition issues and possibly memory issues. So I think whoever it was in his circle who finally persuaded him that he should do the right thing, and he has done the right thing, and it's unusual. I think he's the third president to do this. Washington did it, and then was it Lyndon B. Johnson 6 years ago? And now he's done it as well. So good on him, even if it did take him a bit of time to get there, because he possibly didn't really realise, you know, the full extent of what was happening to him.
Presumably an advisory role will beckon and many laws and so forth. But Graham, if we go back to the start of our conversation, do you feel that, what would you feel Biden's future will be in the context of this campaign and his legacy?
Well, Kamala Harris was very complimentary about him in her first speech. But she also, you know, came up with new ideas. I mean, she made a very good point about it's the voter that's making history, not her, as the first in many areas.
Definitely put, yeah.
Yeah. So, I think it's that's why it's so interesting, is because there's so many people establishing their political styles. everyone is interested in what's how they're going to turn out. You know? And it's quite astonishing the change that Kamala Harris made, the impact, because no one had really thought of it. It was seemingly unthinkable before Biden stepped down. But then once she was actually in the position, people started thinking, hey, this is a great idea. Mm. She really stepped up to the the role.
Yeah. Well, you made the point earlier on, which I thought was very trenchant, that vice presidents are very much sideshows, aren't they, in terms of the political arena. I wonder if that's necessarily a good or useful thing. And I'm thinking over here of Angela Rayner, who, in a Prescottian manner, seems to have been the core of an entire sort of sub-brief across several areas of significant interest. And I suppose some people will inevitably say, as they said with Prescott, well, is the power base, a subversive power base, buildable therein? But with Prescott, we got devolution. We didn't get much with Harris. We got some interventions on the space program, no doubt some sage opinions, but some were saying that Biden didn't treat her all that well, at least wasn't allowed to. But suddenly, she bloometh.
The main point of the vice president, actually, is to balance the ticket and to bring in votes that the presidential candidate would not necessarily garner themselves. And it's different from... And the UK, firstly, we don't have a constitutional position deputy prime minister. There are many people who've been called that, and they deputise for the prime minister when the prime minister is away, but it's not there in the constitution the written constitution, and that being plenty of period. When Geoffrey Howe was deputy prime minister towards the end of his parliamentary career, it was clear that Thatcher just hated the sight of him and never listened to a word that he said, and it was a sinecure in getting rid of him from the Foreign Office. When she moved him from the Foreign Office, she couldn't quite sack him altogether. So the second best thing to sacking him was making him Deputy Prime Minister. And there is a difference, of course, that Angela Rayner is directly elected by the Labour Party, which, again, is very unusual. There's no similar post in the Conservatives, for example, which means that whoever the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party is, they have it was Tom Watson, for example, before, they have a mandate of their own. So although Watson in the Corbyn years, the two of them didn't noticeably get on brilliantly warmly, but it wasn't possible for Corbyn to sack him because he had his, as deputy leader, because he'd been elected by the party to be deputy leader and therefore had a constituency and a democratic legitimacy of his own, in that case, his or her own, whoever the particular individual is. So it's difficult to draw parallels.
Yeah. It's ever fascinating times. Thank you all very much and have a great weekend.
Likewise.
Cheers.
Yeah, cheers. Bye.